Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, this is Jessica, and I am here with
Stacy.
Brenda Janowitz
and Allison Richmond,
and we are going to
turn the page.
First of all, I would like to welcome our guests. Welcome back.
And before we get started, I just wanted to give the audience a little overview, or a bio, if you will, about both of our guests. Brenda Janowitz is the author of 5 novels, and she is also the books correspondent for Pop Sugar. Her 6th novel, The Grace Kelly Dress, will be published by HarperCollins Gradenhouse in March 2020, and Allison Richmond is the number one international best-selling author of 7 novels, including The Velvet Hours, The Garden of Letters, and The Lost Wife. She's also a graduate of Wellesley College and a former Thomas J. Watson Fellow. Her novels have been published in 20 languages and have been bestsellers in several countries. And this I just found out, The Lost Wife is currently in development to be a major motion picture. And as I mentioned before, this is Brenda's 2nd time on Turn the Page. And Allison, also an author, is her friend. So Brenda brought her in. Would you like to tell us a little bit about how your friendship started?
Absolutely. So I met Allie through our mutual friend Pam Jenoff, who's another fabulous writer who I think also has a book on my Pop Sugar winter list this year. And so she connected Allie and I because we live near each other. And just that one initial meeting sort of blossomed into a real friendship, which is so lovely because in book world, you know lots of people, but it's a little rarer, I think, to make a true real friend. Yeah. So, yeah. I like to say Allie's my friend in real life, as opposed to just on Facebook.
That's so nice.
Yes, it's definitely a friendship that lifts off the page, right?
Oh, I like that.
Wordplay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, maybe this is a special off the page. Turn the page.
I love it. So, needless to say, I'm a huge fan of Allie's work. I think she's a brilliant writer, a really beautiful writer. In addition to being a good friend, but we're here to talk about the writing part. So I was really thrilled when Allie told me about her latest book, and I feel like we talked about it a lot through its inception, and now here we are. I guess this will broadcast after pub date, but we're a few weeks before pub date, so it's really exciting.
Yes, I'm scheduling this for the last day in February, because this isn't leap year, right? So February 28th is the last Thursday in February.
And the Secret of Clouds launches February 19th, so it'll already be out, hopefully, in your library.
Yeah, so let's dig in. So Allie, tell us about this fabulous book you've written.
Well, The Secret of Clouds is actually my first contemporary novel. Previously, I had published 6 historical novels, and it came about truly because I was inspired by a local teacher in Syosset who, a few months before the school session started telling me about how every year she assigns to her 3rd grade class to write a letter to their 18-year-old self. And she holds onto those letters until the day these children graduate from high school. And I was immediately blown away that there was a teacher who was so dedicated that she would actually create a project that was 10 years long, because her entire basement, you know, has these filing cabinets where she stores these letters. And these letters are written in the students', you know, childlike hand, you know, handwriting to themselves, and she puts the postage on these letters, and on the back of the envelope it says a message from the past with a letter from the past with a message to the future. And I just thought that was so beautiful and really showed a teacher's dedication to her students. But on another level, it also made me think what happens within 10 years of a child's life. And what happens within 10 years of a teacher's life. And And how does that lasting bond that it's forged as early as the third grade, you know, in the third grade, does that last? What happens in the arc of both of their lives? And so that from that first sort of seed of awe of what is, you know, of a teacher's dedication, it started to take more universal themes of what happens within a life of two people. And how do they transform each other's life? So the Secret of Clouds really came about on a sunny day on Long Island at the poolside as a teacher prepared, you know, her syllabus for the year. And it's, to me, my I always describe it as a love letter to that beautiful teacher-student relationship. I think almost everyone here can probably, you know, definitively say that they had a teacher who changed their life or had an impact on their life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They play a big role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's true. I love hearing you talk about the inspiration, because I think it's so interesting how a novel sort of comes to life. And I think, I'm sure you agree, a lot of times when we're speaking about our books, the question we're most asked is, how did you get this idea? Mm-hmm. And for me, ideas are sort of everywhere. And it's like, what doesn't inspire me? But the bigger question is, what actually makes a book? So can you talk a little about how you took this little germ of an idea and turned it into a novel?
Right. So it's true. So I always say inspiration hits you in the most unlikely of places. You know, my book, The Lost Wife, you know, part of the inspiration took place in a hair salon overhearing a story. Another time I got an idea at a cocktail party. But from that small seed, so much does germinate from that, because you need, you know, a multi-layered story, one that sort of connects on many different levels. So from that small part, I started to also think about how I can weave in history into this book. Even though I knew it would be a contemporary novel, I didn't want to ignore that I come from a historical background in writing. And so for my readers who have enjoyed me in the past, I wanted to make sure there was still some sort of thread that was woven through the book where they felt that they were learning something that they didn't know. And so I look back into my own life and my children's life, and I remembered that there was a story that I had never quite, shaken from my memory, and that was that I had a babysitter for my son when he was first born, who was an immigrant from the Ukraine. Or Ukraine, I'm not supposed to say the Ukraine. And she had been a nurse in Kiev right after Chernobyl happened. And she had told me about how for many years after that fact, children were born with very rare heart defects, sometimes childhood cancers, and that it was particularly painful because they had no idea when the nuclear accident occurred that there was radiation in their environment, that the government, the Soviet Union, kept it a secret for over 3 days. It wasn't until Sweden saw on their satellites that there was, you know, some sort of new cloud going.
Yes,
you
know. I remember reading about that.
Okay. So I really had these very visceral memories of her discussing how it was so sunny on those days that they actually went out and they sunburned themselves, or that the water in the river that ran through Kiev was so warm that people went swimming in it. And so I wanted to create a child that is an immigrant who comes from Ukraine, whose parents have fled after that has happened, who is really searching for a connection because he has to be homeschooled, and this teacher comes into his home, and she learns about his family's history. She learns about his particular vulnerability because he is born with a rare heart defect that prevents him from going to school. And yet my teacher, Maggie Topper, mm-hmm. the main character, she still assigns to him the same letter writing that she does to all her students. And so his letter becomes a time capsule for what he's feeling at that moment in his childhood. And I wanted to do that because I feel like most people, you might have been aware of the Chernobyl.
But it wasn't, mm-hmm. You know, like I knew what Chernobyl was, but that particular aspect of it, you know, it hit me not too long ago. You know, you get like every now and then you're down the rabbit hole, you can't sleep, and you're just like, oh, I'm going to read like a list mm-hmm. or something. And it's like, you know, the top 10 things you didn't know about, and
Chernobyl. Right. And there have been a lot of photographs, like on BuzzFeed and things, at Pripyat, the abandoned town where the reactor had been.
That's probably what led me down that rabbit hole, because I think, like, I have a fascination with abandoned places.
Okay, so that has been sort of going viral, and you see, you know, what happened. But because we were, you know, had this sort of iron curtain for so long, especially during our childhood, we didn't really know so much of the information. So I decided to take, again, something very small historically that my readers, you know, probably did not know about, and weave that into the background of one of my characters. So that became another layer to the book. But then also, again, not wanting to ignore my audience, every book that I've written has always had some sort of art historical thread that ran through it, or some sort of way in which I weave in the creative process. I'm the daughter of an abstract artist, and before I became a writer, I imagined that I would become a painter like my mother. But, you know, my mother said, I think the paycheck will be better with a writer. The jury's still out on that.
You just paint with your words. It's a different type of painting.
Yeah, so it's true. I really do try. Like, when I write each chapter, I do imagine it as a small composition, and that each sentence is this brushstroke that I try and, you know, move you through that story in a very visual way. So in the past, I've written about, you know, painters in The Lost Wife, a cellist in The Garden of Letters, an actor in The Rhythm of Memory. In this book, I decided to have the main character's mother be a ballerina from the Soviet Union. I was able to research what it was like, the training for a dancer in Ukraine at that time, and the competitiveness. You know, there's great little seeds of information about how they put, you know, crushed glass in each other's toe shoes, or a lighter under the leg to make the arabesque higher.
I've heard a few. I heard about the glass.
the glass. But I interviewed a ballet dancer on Long Island who had come from Romania, and she had told me how her teacher always held a cigarette lighter underneath her leg and said, "Higher, higher, or you're going to burn your, you know."
Oh my gosh, that's intense.
So, you know, for my readers, hopefully, who have read me in the past, there's still those important things that I love to sort of, you know, have in my novels. But again, it is a contemporary novel that takes place on Long Island.
That's exciting. I love that. So tell us more about the research in terms of teachers and the teaching experience. I felt like when I read the book, it was such a vivid experience of a young teacher. And not being a teacher yourself, how did you get that so right?
Oh, that's a good question, because I got so much of it wrong in the beginning. And I think I needed to have so many teachers read my novel to make sure that I did get it right, because I don't have the mentality of a teacher. For example, when my friend who had inspired this novel was reading the first draft, there was a scene in the book where a child hit another child with the backpack by accident, and I had my teacher character, you know, to herself think that the child was faking the extent of her injury. And she said, no teacher would ever think that someone was faking it. Their immediate reaction would be compassion. And I was like, oh, I guess this is the frustrated mother on my part that thinks that my son.
I can jump right in right there. I think I always joke around to Stacy. Like, one of my sons is, he's, I mean, I love him, and he does have authentic, but he's also very good at with crocodile tears sometimes.
Right. So having had two children, I always feel they're sort of inflating the extent of their injury. So, you know, small little things like that, or, you know, when my character actually is able to go to school, the sense that they would be preparing the classroom with, you know, antiseptic cleaner, and would they be able to have that cleaner approved by the, you know, the school, that it didn't have any chemicals, all these things that I didn't normally think about. But the mentality of a teacher, especially a young teacher who is so earnest and wanting to do the right thing, it was pointed out to me that it's very different than a teacher sometimes who has been teaching for 30 years. And so I have two, you know, teachers in the book. There's one that has, you know, a little bit more experience and perhaps sounds jaded, although her heart is really in the right place and you learn her backstory. But Maggie is, you know, a second year teacher, very much wanting to prove herself, wanting to forge a connection with her students, right, you know, from the get-go. And learning about how passionate, you know, and selfless teachers are really, you know, made me want to infuse that spirit into the novel.
Mm, I love that. So the contemporary setting will be something new for your readers, but there's also something really unexpected in this novel that, knowing you as a person and as a writer, I did not expect to see in there. When I think of Ali Richman, I think of all things beautiful. So when I knew that there would be a ballerina, I thought, yes, that's perfect for my friend Ali. But there was quite a bit of baseball. I know you have a son. I have two sons as well. So I guess we know a little about sports, but there's no way you knew that much about baseball. So let's talk about baseball in this novel.
So you make me smile because in my, you know, my publisher did a Q&A to go with my press release with this book, and one of the questions was, what was the most difficult part of the research of The Secret of Clouds? And I said, this is going to surprise everyone, but it was baseball. So, yes, I think, you know, for those of us who are mothers, when you imagine yourself with a child, you think it's going to be an exact mini-me of yourself, even if it's a boy. My great surprise in my journey as a mother is that my son, from the time he was five, was an incredible passionate baseball fan, memorized statistics, every player, used to do baseball math where he would say the number of a jersey plus another number from another corresponding team and see if he could get the number at the end. So I was not prepared for travel baseball, and the fact that I used to joke when I would drive him home after taking him an hour early before practice, the game, which lasted sometimes 3 hours long, and then the ride home, that I could have been in Paris in this amount of time. So,
see, that's the Ali I know.
And my son, from his perspective, would say, why do you, take a picnic basket and a big hat and read until I'm up at bat and not look at my other friends playing? And I would have to say, well, I don't really understand the game, Zachary, and I want to get the reading done. So the alley that you are painting of not being drawn to baseball or wanting to put it in a book is 100% accurate. But this is a book that takes place on Long Island against the backdrop of the Subway series of the Mets and the Yankees playing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And a little boy. And the little boy wasn't going to, in this case, be drawn to the ballet world of his mother or, another artistic world, as much as I wanted him to be. And that would be much easier for me. So,
and you know what? Sometimes that does happen.
That does happen, of course.
But absolutely. But your characters tell you who they are.
Yes. And in this case, because this boy, for the most part, is not able to go to school and to interact with other children, baseball becomes a lifeline to him, and to see that, and to connect with his father. His father also wanting to, to connect with American life and culture, baseball becomes that connection too. So researching baseball was really sort of fascinating because not only did I ask my son about why he loved baseball, I started to ask his pitching coach. I started to ask the men who, were on the sidelines of the games, people who were, there's a local Long Island young man named Sam Menzin, and he now, I think, works for the Tigers. And he was really essential because he was a child during the Subway series. And he told me about how his entire room was, plastered with, different images of Andy Pettit or, about, all the people that he loved, Mariano Rivera, why he loved them. And so getting his memories on that really sort of opened up how I was going to write Yuri. So I tried to do my due diligence. It doesn't come from a true passion of baseball by any stretch of the imagination. But even if you have a contemporary novel that takes place in the 90s, you do want your book to have an historic accuracy and an emotional resonancy, I think, that comes from interviewing true life people who love that sport.
Absolutely. I was checking with my husband as I was reading. I was sort of like, did this really? Okay. What? And I kept trying to read ahead and say to him, okay, so what happened in the Subway series? And he was like, read the book. So there was also more research you had to do because you mentioned how this child was born at the time of Chernobyl and there were lots of different unintended...
consequences.
Yeah, And so... is it giving away too much to talk about Yuri and his health and sort of how this teacher comes into his life?
No, I don't think so. I mean, certainly I think it's important to say that he has a sense of, he's very fragile. And one of the things that I wanted to do and make sure that was accurate was to say, if a child is born with Epstein's anomaly, would he be able to go to school at this time? And so it's quite funny because I know you know, as our friendship blossomed, I learned that your husband is a pediatric cardiologist, and I had already spoken to his, when I mentioned the pediatric cardiologist that had helped me with my research, it ended up being one of his partners. Mm-hmm. So when I spoke to Dr. Lovechek, you know, Lovechek, what he had said to me is that it was completely plausible and that, you know, it would have been a concern. He certainly could have gone to school, but he certainly, you know, if there had been reason for concern, it made sense. So I did create this almost cocoon-like shelter that he's living in with his family, because they are new immigrants. They haven't completely assimilated into American life. And it was, I don't want to say it was easy to put myself in Yuri's mother's shoes, but we had all, you know, being a mother and worrying and what that intensity of worrying would have been if you knew your son was born with a rare heart defect. I wanted to make that very intense in the book.
Yeah, I thought it was incredible and very well done. And right, as a mom, you know, we often say a child is like your heart, mm-hmm. just sort of walking around right. the earth. And there's something so beautiful yet terrifying about that. So of course, it would be intensified so much
right.
if there was.
And there's something very beautiful and poignant when you do talk about a child's heart, either metaphorically or, you know, I mean, even when we went out to dinner with your husband and he said, a child's heart begins the size of a walnut, you know, or a closed fist. And mm-hmm. as it grows, it mirrors that fist. It's a very visual image that I wanted to work with. Also, the sense when you do hold your child for the first time and you hear their heartbeat against yours and knowing how essential that heartbeat is for life, that gave it this sense of poignancy that this child is born with this fragile heart. So I don't know if any of you have read The Art of Hearing Heartbeats. It's a beautiful novel by Jan-Philipp Sendecker.
I haven't, but okay. I know everyone loves it.
It's beautiful. And I had the privilege of spending some time in Norway with him this May for a book festival, and he talked about how that title came about because as he was holding his son against his chest, you know, as a toddler, his father, the child heard his heartbeat and asked him about, you know, he didn't say the art of hearing heartbeats, but what is that sound?
Yeah.
And he thought about this beauty, you know, and this rhythm that his son was hearing from his own chest beating. So it's something very beautiful as a writer, I think, to work with this sense of the human heart.
I love that. So now's the part where I ask you, can you tell us what you're working on next?
Sure.
Am I allowed?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm working on a novel now called The Rivers of Grace that actually also was inspired by a true Long Island story. So it seems like there's a lot of inspiration, as you mentioned, all around us. We just have to open our ears.
Homegrown inspiration.
Yeah.
It's about a young Vietnamese refugee boy who comes over to the United States in the 80s and how his life intersects with a woman who is an Irish immigrant on the south shore of Long Island. And so I took that small seed and I opened it up too because I wanted to create more layers. And so I also have a Vietnam veteran in the book and how all three of these lives intersect and help, I don't want to say cause a sense, but help inspire a sense of healing between all three characters because they are suffering from certain hauntings in their past.
That sounds amazing. First of all, I love it. So I know we've talked about this before. So what you're really known for, your books in the past have been sort of, let's call it broadly, World War II novels. Mm-hmm. And with The Secret of Clouds, we're talking about Chernobyl. But now you're moving to a Vietnam vet, mm-hmm. the Vietnam War. And that's something Kristen Hanna did. Mm-hmm. First, she did The Nightingale, which is a World War II story. And then she did The Great Alone, which had a Vietnam vet in it. And we talked a little, well, can you talk a little mm-hmm. about World War II?
And Vietnam.
And
so interesting. So when I started, researching this book, I didn't know that Kristen Hanna was writing a Vietnam vet. So I can't say it came about from that. And I think you were at my book review event with Jenna Blum when someone in the audience asked both of us, did we ever think of doing something you know, with the Vietnam War. And I was sort of blown away because I said, actually, that is what I'm working on now. And I think it is a natural progression from World War II, which when I wrote The Lost Wife, which was my first World War II book, I started writing that book in 2004. Is that right? My daughter is born in 2006. No, so 2008 came in 2011. So 10 years ago. And one of the things, and that was really before there was this explosion of Holocaust fiction. You had just had Sarah's Key, but Jenna Blum's book, Those Who Save Us. But it wasn't the way it is now, where there's a really super saturation of World War II Holocaust novels.
Very popular.
But one of the exciting things on doing research like that was that there were still many survivors who were in their 70s and 80s who really, as you know, they became older, were starting to feel that they would speak with people and share their some of their stories that they had never shared with anyone before. I mean, many of them had done oral histories for the Holocaust Museum, sponsored through Steven Spielberg's Shoah Foundation, but still it wasn't something that was, you know, part of a constant dialogue. And so I felt very privileged to be able to weave in many personal stories that were shared with me through different survivors into The Lost Wife. And it really changed my life because it showed the power of sharing story and creating universal themes that can connect us, whether we're, you know, Jewish, white, black, you know, Asian, it doesn't matter, that it's their universal themes of love and connection of family and these things wanting to triumph over great darkness and evil. So Vietnam is, I think, a part of our history in which a lot of stories have not been told. These men came back from fighting a war that they often did not believe in, but they were inscripted to fight. Often from very poor parts of America where they weren't educated and they were sent over at, you know, the age of 18, unprepared for what they were going to see and deal with.
There does, if you don't mind me jumping in, there does seem to be, because my grandfather fought in World War II, and there does seem to be just a very different
reaction.
Yes.
The World War II heroes came back to, you know, ticker tape parades, and the Vietnam War veterans came back to terrible things being said to them when they got off the plane. So I really wanted to sort of create a book in which their voice could be heard, and their backstory and what they endured when they came home. And then the contrast with a young Vietnamese refugee boy who also doesn't speak English is fleeing, you know, terrible circumstances to come to America. And how do those two people collide, and how do they heal? To me, that's really fascinating. But I'm in the process now. I mean, I have started the first 100 pages, but I spent the last 6 months basically interviewing Vietnam veterans who were willing to share their story with me, and it's been incredibly powerful.
That sounds like it's going to be another really compelling read.
I'm
excited you told us about that. But back to The Secret of Clouds, tell us about the postcards you brought.
So the publisher actually printed these beautiful postcards with the cover on them. I'm going to leave a few at behind it with the Syosset Library. So if they want to leave them at the circulation.
Come to the Syosset Library.
And these cards.
You can only get them here.
You can only get them here.
That's right.
These cards are meant to, they're postcards that you can send to a teacher that you remember in your life or that you feel had an impact on your children's life. And just say thank you. Because one of the things that I wanted to do when I set out to write this book is to say thank you to all these amazing teachers who really do help shape future lives and to instill a sense of compassion, a love of books, probably a love of the library, but powerful educators who are really doing good in a world where we need good.
So let's end this with each of us telling a personal anecdote about a teacher who's really touched our lives. Because when I saw those postcards, the first person I thought of was Mrs. Rossler, my first grade teacher. She had such a massive impact on my life. She was this wonderful teacher, but she really believed in all of her students, and she really believed in me. And I think bolstering me with that confidence enabled me to do everything that I was able to do in my life. It sort of set me up. You know, she would make you feel smart, and so that made you want to rise to the occasion and do your best. And it's something that has carried me throughout my life. And in fact, a lot of my first grade classmates and I are now friends with her on Facebook. And it's the biggest treat because we get to tell her all the time how special she was and how much she meant to us.
I'm going to mention also my first grade teacher.
Oh, my goodness.
Who, Mrs. Goldberg in St. James Elementary School, put a piece of paper in front of all of us one day and a blob of tempera paint, folded it, and then said, write what you see. And I think that is really how I live every day. What do I see? It's not just what I see in my mind, but what do I see in my heart? And I think that's such a beautiful thing to think. When we were 6 years old, she told us to look down at a piece of paper and say, write what you see.
That's beautiful.
No, you could go first, Jessica, because I have to sort through the teachers.
I know,
in my head.
I'm doing the same thing. I guess I'll jump to a different time in my life. Just, and you know, I did cite him once in another podcast, but I'll do it again because I had a wonderful professor in college who was my film theory professor. And, you know, I mean, I had wonderful, wonderful teachers in elementary school and in high school. And, but I think he just had such a unique approach to everything. And, you know, no matter if his class was at 9 a.m. or you always wanted to be there. His name was Harris Ross, and he passed away recently.
Oh,
I know.
So
it was surreal in its own way.
Of course.
Yeah. He was just such a wonderful man whose warmth and humor radiated through everything he did. And he made me a Hitchcock fan, I know.
Ooh.
Yes. So definitely Harris Ross.
I still can't think of one, so I'm just going to spout off the three in my head. My third grade teacher, Mrs. McCaslin, and my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Minkoff. Mrs. McCaslin, because it was to think outside the box and do fun things that you could learn from. Mrs. Minkoff, to be true to yourself. I remember doing that because she... Like, one of the first things we did in class was an icebreaker of throwing a yarn ball and connecting with people. And you say something about yourself that maybe they don't know. And these are, you know, kids you've been K through third already. And I was like, you want to know what? Like, all right, I like this. I love icebreakers. And then my college professor, Professor Pindell, I had him twice for, like, English Lit. He's a huge fan of... like Faulkner and all that, which I'm not, but he came to me after one of class. He's like, why don't you like talk more in class? Like you write like good papers, like talk more, like seriously stop shortchanging yourself. Like I'll start like failing you. And I'm like, all right, sorry, Pindell. And like, it was just, you know, don't ever like shortchange yourself. Be proud of who you are and what you can do. So I like that.
Yeah, I think that was another thing with Dr. Ross, because at the time I was really leaning towards film theory, and you know, he became my advisor, and you know, like there's always, you know, it's a tough field, and he's like, yeah, you know, somebody's got to do it, why not you? And even though, yeah, okay, so I didn't go into that field, it's still part of my background and my, you know, my passion. Like if you get me talking about film theory, you will not get me to stop, so I'm stopping now. But there really is that sense of, you know, like, you know, like somebody's got to do it. You know,
I think what I'm hearing from everyone, just isn't the outsider at the podcast, is that all three of you have mentioned that these people had belief in you. And so I think what's extraordinary about teachers is that, you know, for the most part, all of us have parents that we, you know, hope believe in us. But when who are the first outside mm-hmm. people who believe in you? And I think that's universally our teachers. Mm-hmm. And that's why we remember those who did make you feel that you could do anything, that possibility was infinite. And I think that's why we owe them a great thank you.
I agree. Thank you. So thank you very much for coming here. This is Jessica and
Stacy.
And we are with
Brenda Janowitz
and Allison Richmond.
And we are going to close this chapter of
Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.